So I was going to talk about back to gender. This is his mother. So few people assume that the mother is the attending physician or the surgeon, but I'm not going to say that we have to go back to gender again. But the idea is that, and don't worry, I asked a group of people one time this, and they were 7 children of a female medical doctor, and they didn't get it right either. My wife and her siblings missed it. I mean, their grandma W is a physician. So the idea is that we sometimes assume that only men are going to be doctors. Into class, too, because there are certain jobs, certain status positions in society that people might say, well, yeah, that's going to go to men or whatever. But it's often about education, power, money, and income, and so forth. And medical doctors, there's actually much, you know, people are probably more likely to become really, really wealthy if they go into business. And so forth. So we get into class, and this is from Oxfam. It says that the top 1% of people in the world, in terms of net wealth, control 46% of the world's wealth. So 1% of all the people in the world, about 46% of the world's wealth. If you put Americans in that category, most of Americans are going to come in the top 10%. If you're making poverty, or minimum wage in the United States, you're still probably in the top 10% of the world. And so we have a proportion of the world of disparity, of inequality. As this cartoon says, still not enough. The top 1% maybe wants even more. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Now, class is different than being just rich or wealth. It's also other aspects here. We often talk about SES or economic status. So you get your social status, your economics together, and people that we think of as being high class, low class, middle class, upper middle class, and so forth. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, we have written by the wealthiest man in the world at that time, and probably still would be considered the wealthiest man in the world. Ecclesiastes 5, written by the preacher, Solomon. Verse 8. If thou seest the oppression of the poor, and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. So God is looking over this all, and he sees the matter. We may see inequality and justice. We get upset about, you know, how can this be? The poor are being oppressed, they're lacking, they're in hunger. Well, God is higher. There was a case a number of years ago, I remember, stories of food insecurity in Haiti. And people in the mountains were eating dirt, not because it would give them any nutrition, but just to fill their stomachs. Whereas you go not too far away in a place like Las Vegas, you have huge buffets of food going on. I worked in a buffet in Indiana for one summer, and at the end of the day, we'd have to throw away everything that was left. Couldn't get to the local homeless shelter, couldn't take it across the street to my apartment. Just got tossed. And there's an abundance, but it's not always spread around. And so if we see this, well, God knows what's taking place. Verse 9, moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. So we all should take part in the abundance of the world. There's enough food in the world to support everybody, but just properly. Verse 10, he that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver. Our cartoon here. It's not enough. We're the top 1%. We own 46% of the earth. We want more. Nor he that loveth abundance with increase. Vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there by to the owners thereof, saving the beholden of them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not. He's going to be worried. You know, I have all this stuff. I can't go to sleep because what if somebody breaks into my house and takes my bank account, you know, with identity theft or my social security number and steals from me while I'm sleeping? How can we sleep if we're rich? If we know we're working, we're going to work the next day to get more stuff and more food, then we're going to sleep at night because we know we can work again the next day. But if you have abundance of wealth, you're not maybe having to work, then you might not be able to sleep. There's a sore evil which I have, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. So if you think about wealth, status, rich, who do we feel sorriest for in this cartoon? Well, probably the 54% on the lower part of the globe all get food, but actually, from this, we might feel sorry for the 1% who have all this abundance and they accumulate all this wealth to their hurt. I mentioned the U.S. being at the levels here of wealth. We see on this chart, you have many European countries, Northern European countries, and so forth. In terms of the, I apologize, it's not that visible here. But the U.S. is up there. It gets less and less as you go down below. And so average income here around the world, average threshold of wealth. And so we, just living in the United States with clean running water, with sanitary water that we can, you know, and not have to worry that's going to come out contaminated or oozing toxins and so forth. This gives us an abundance that much of the world does not possess. Do we feel guilty about that? Should we feel guilty? What is our position? Now, and of course, here in the U.S., we might not feel wealthy. Maybe you don't feel like I'm talking to a wealthy audience here. Well, you know, many of us would probably be seen just by, you know, being able to have the time off on a Saturday to come here and be together and a time off again tomorrow on a Sunday. We're probably not going to be people working three watching together. You know, we have the luxury of taking time off. Our bosses have not fired us just because you came here this weekend. And so we have, and that puts us probably in a different class than those who are just trying to scrape to make ends meet. This is by a Christian personal finance specialist out of Franklin, Tennessee. Not Dave Ramsey, although that's also where he lives. But the idea here is 80% of millionaires are first generation. Are we born into these identities or is it a choice? Well, we're born into families. We're born into households that may or may not take care of us and so forth. And we're born into an economic situation we don't necessarily. But then what do we do with that? There is some choice. And so 80% of all people in the U.S. today who are millionaires are the first ones in their family line to become millionaires. And so most millionaires are with a silver spoon in their mouth, necessarily. They have worked hard or invested hard or done something to get to that point. However, the small print down below points out that 70% of wealth made by that first generation, so second generation, 70% of them, the wealth is gone by that time. By the time you get to the third generation, the grandchildren of the first generation millionaires, 90% of the wealth is gone. So they might say the first generation, they're working hard, they don't have time to spend their money. They're hard at work. They're, you know, working on the railroads, the Vanderbilts, the great patriarch of the Vanderbilts that made a lot of money. He saw a need for a ferry on Staten Island, between Staten Island and Manhattan, went back and forth with his own power for a while until they got better technology and so forth. And he worked hard, and then bought railroads and shipping lines. And third generation, it was all gone. He worked hard. The second generation came along, and they sacrificed. They saw the sacrifice of the first generation, and they helped to steward it. They kept it going as well. Third generation, though, they didn't need to work. And they didn't work. They just spent, had lavish parties, and it was all gone. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 18. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that should me. Now, is this your son? Is this the neighbor who profits off your estate sale and buys your house or farm at a cheap auction or whatever? But you're working hard, and someday we can't take it with us. We're not arrows that think we can take all our money and, you know, possessions and put in a pyramid and we'll keep it with us. That doesn't work. That didn't work for the pharaohs. It doesn't work for us. So we're not going to take it with us. He's resenting the person's going to come after him. Could be the next generation. They won't have to work for his millions or whatever, and he worked hard. Who knoweth, verse 19, whether he should be a wise man or a fool? Here's why he's resenting them. Well, am I raising a child take that money and use it for the best, for the greater good? Or am I going to, is somebody's going to just waste it on themselves? I'll admit, I said I'm a shopper. I like to shop. And I look at my dad's choices in life. He's not a shopper. He took good care of me all growing up, but he never really spent anything on himself. And so I come along. I've been taken care of by my dad growing up. I come along and maybe I'll take care of myself. You know, so eventually the next generations don't have to make those tough sacrifices. So eventually we get to be a little more free and easy with our income and not have to scrimp and save as maybe the Great Depression generation did, or those who came out of World War II and so forth. So we have choices. We might not feel as much like as our generation. We have to scrimp and save, and we're okay having a little more leisure, a little more fun time, buying memberships to the local whatever. So we have this difference of opinion here. And he said, am I hard? And I'm going to die someday and leave behind this inheritance to a wise man or a fool. We don't know what's going to happen to that money later. Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I've labored, and wherein I've showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. So when I'm dead, the next generation will take over anything I left behind, the house, the car, the clothes, the furniture, investments, and what will they do with it? It's vanity. Therefore, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. So do we just not work? It's all pointless. We can't take it with us anyways. We just stop working, stop laboring, stop investing. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity. Yet to man that hath not labored, therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what hath man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows and his trouble. Yea, his heart doth not rest in the night. This is also vanity. Heard about a personal finance expert who gave a lot of talks about how to invest your money appropriately. He became a multi-millionaire. And he told people great advice for retirement so that when you live into retirement, people are living longer. You might see a standard living, you might end up dying in the 60s, now people live until the 90s. He told people how to save to have a secure retirement. But he himself was in the 60s. And he couldn't take it with him. He had all this mass accumulation of investments he could never spend, never see the benefits of. It's all vanity. So is class, is family income worthless? How do you plant your family tree? I mentioned the Vanderbilts all collapsed. The Rockefellers, though, it did. They kept their money and they invested and it became very wealthy and they spread their wealth around and invested in museums and universities. And there is a but the Vanderbilts, we know when the last generation died out and they left with nothing. They tried to, the first generation was hardworking. The second generation, they had some sons and daughters that had in New York City. In today's dollars, each of these parts might go for $3 million blown in one night. Entertainment and food and everything. And it's gone. It just vanishes. It's all vanity. So we have various ways in which we can look at class, and I'm going to look at those who have money. Where do they get it? How do they get it? What do they do with it? And so you might have heard the term old money versus new money. So there's a lot of stereotypes about old money, new money. Old money are those who have been in the family for a while, maybe like the Rockefellers. It's been there for a while, and they get used to it. They get accustomed to it, and they realize they don't have to flash it anymore. They don't have to prove themselves to anyone. They're just wealthy. They don't have to show it off anymore. And so the old money is the idea that you don't have to have, you know, big designer, flashy logos. You just kind of look normal. So here's an ad for old money summer outfits. You know, like kind of a normal, you know, casual business attire. Nothing too flashy. You can't tell, you know, where they got their jacket or pants or whatever. It's just kind of looks normal, but it's probably very good quality fabric and so forth. But the thing is, they're not really lavish about their, not trying to show what they have. Matthew chapter 6. Now, we who are born as humans don't have a choice about how we are about who we're born to and the net worth of our parents and so on, we do have a choice about who we're going to follow. And we'll talk more and more about being part of the kingdom of the family of God. But our Father owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, if we've chosen to belong to Christ. And our Father owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, so we don't need to worry. We don't have to prove ourselves to anyone. We are high class in the sense that we belong to a Father who owns everything. So why try to signal our own things? You know, we think about gold. And gold might be, you know, it's the most, one of the most, I mean, platinum is probably higher, but one of the most sought after minerals right now. Platinum is probably more valuable, but gold is up there. And so, you know, we think about, okay, if I have a show off my gold, then people will know I'm wealthy. But why bother doing that? We're told that the New Jerusalem, the kingdom of heaven someday, will have streets of gold. So we'll show up there with, you know, say we could try to, you know, pocket some gold here on this earth and you to heaven, and you get there, and it's like, well, you brought macadam, asphalt, blacktop. Like, why'd you work all your life for what we're walking on up here? So we don't have to prove ourselves anyway. We belong to the Lord, and the Lord, us not just believers, but He takes care of the flowers of the field. He takes care of everyone. Matthew 6, verse 24. No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. You can't serve God and the resources, the monies, the wages of this world. And so you got to choose your employer or God. You got, you know, if there's a choice, follow God. You know, give up the income if you have to. Why worry? Therefore, I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat or what ye shall drink, nor yet for your body, what ye shall put on. Is not the life more than meat and the body than raiment? Behold the fowls of the air. They sow not, neither do they reap, nor your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are you not much better than they? If we could just trust the Lord, you know, if we think we're working and scrimping and saving and you know, have something in the future, well, why? We can't guarantee that theft is not going to come. We can't guarantee that it will not be taken or that we won't die before it gets to that point. In Proverbs, we're told that I have not seen the righteous begging bread. And so God will take care of our day-to-day bread. You pray the Our Father, and we give thanks for our daily bread. God will provide, just like He did man provide for you. Not that we're trying to test Him by, you know, not canning and putting some things in the refrigerator for the next week or whatever, but we know if worse comes to worse, God can provide. He provides for the flowers of the field, and why do you know, our thought for raiment, verse 28, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. We can work, you know, spend hours of work every week just to have a nice set of clothes to wear. And, well, the lilies, it just comes naturally. They just flourish there. We don't have to scrimp and save. Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast in the oven, should not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith. And he says, you know, the Gentiles are seeking things, what you're going to eat, what you're going to put on. You, your heavenly Father, knoweth that you have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Our choice here is to follow the God. Not that we want to, you know, say, well, my Father owns a cattle on 1,000 hills, and therefore I want to be our goal. But know that we can trust God. He will take care of us. And so it's not unlike the Gentiles or the world, as we would say in our modern Christian circles, unlike the world that, you know, tries so hard to put on, our kingdom is not of this world, and our Father, though, will take care of us for what we have need of. He knows what we need, and sufficient on the day is the evil thereof. Don't worry about tomorrow and worry about, you know, we'll have money when I retire and so forth. I'll give a disclaimer about that. God can take care of you. You don't have to worry about all this income. So that's old money. Old money, you know, the old money Rockefellers and so forth might say, well, we don't have to show off these so-called designer clothes or have the fanciest cars because we know we have a trust fund and we're set. Well, we as believers know that our Father, which art in heaven, has a future mansion for us, and so we don't have to show off our status. New money, though, it's new to them. It's kind of like, show it off, you know, take selfies in front of your private jet and your fancy suit and dress here and stuff. New money is a little more with their bling and so forth. So, 1 Peter chapter 3. Apparently this was a concern in the early church. Now, I will say, it's talking here about wives and women, but as I said this morning, in my household, spending, so this is to me, not just to my wife, okay? Verse 3 of 1 Peter 3, whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair and of wearing of gold or putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. So, how we exhibit wealth is not the way the world exhibits wealth. The world is not going to exhibit wealth the same way we they're looking at, you know, the more diamonds, the more, you know, the Bentleys, the Rolls, and so forth. They have all kinds of, you know, the list of logos and things they're seeking after go on. But for people who are of a meek and quiet spirit is a true treasure. A meek and quiet spirit is where you really are exhibiting true spiritual wealth, the wealth that matters to the Almighty One. But let it be that hidden man of the heart, not corruptible. Your vehicles will rust, your hobbies will, someday you won't be able to partake in the hobbies anymore, won't have the health to do so. I've heard of people who, they talk about people who go into retirement. There's the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years. People who first come into retirement, they're raring to go. They want to spend their money. They've saved up. They're the go-go. Then they get people that are like, yeah, they've done their travel. They've done their time. They're ready to just take it slow. And there's those who just care, hospital beds and nursing homes. They can't go. And so at a certain point, you might have lots of wealth and not be able to spend it. It's corruptible. It's not going to go with us. It's not going to last. Our ability to spend it won't last either. And so of a meek and quiet spirit, things that will transcend eternity, go beyond what we have here on this earth, what we can think of. We look at the Joneses or the neighbors down the road. You might think about, are you the Joneses or do you want to? A lot of people want to be the Joneses. There was a survey taken of people about what we value. Let's imagine that you could live in City A. Let's say you could live in Virginia. We'll say state, and make $80,000 a year, and your neighbors are making $40,000 a year. Or you can move to, let's say, Alabama, and you can make $120,000 a year, but your neighbors are making $160,000. Where would you rather live? Well, most people would say they'd rather live in Alabama. I'm sorry, they'd rather live in Virginia, making less money, but making more than their neighbors around them. Because so often our class, our status, our income, other people. So you might say, well, I'm making, you know, $40,000. As long as I'm making more than my next door neighbor, as long as I'm making more than my sibling, that's good. You might be making more money moving somewhere else, but next door neighbor who's making more money than you. So that's what comes naturally. We want to be the people who are making more than our neighbor. Doesn't matter if we're not making as much as we could if we moved to another state, but we want to make more than those around us. We want to be the Joneses in many cases. And so are we trying to, you know, prove ourselves and compare ourselves among ourselves? Now, it's not only and class, though, can have impacts on other parts of our society. It could impact our health, education, and so forth. So I want to talk real briefly about food. I love food. And so you'll notice me throughout the weekend here eating. So it's been said that there's a difference between how lower class, middle class, and upper class interact with food. Lower class, it's about abundance, quantity. And it's natural to need calories to survive. Throughout human history, having calories, having protein, having access to food was a benefit. In fact, the Bible even talks about the liberal soul waxeth fat. It was a good thing. Fat was good. It talks about teeth for those that are not following God, which means they're not going to have food to eat. And so food was often tied into wealth. You want to have, you're blessed if you have food at your disposal. But for many people who might be low income or lower, so-called lower class, you worry that you won't have food tomorrow, so you'll eat, you know, as much as you can today. So you're looking for quantity. Now, I worked at a buffet. I like quantity. I'll admit that. I like quantity. But middle class, they know there's going to be food in their refrigerator and their canning restaurants for tomorrow. They don't have to eat it all today. So for the middle class, it's more about quality. Do you have salads? Do you have, you know, good, healthy, organic vegetables? Do you have, you know, good fruit juices? So middle class, they need quantity. They need calories. But once you know that you have food, then it's more about, now you get more picky. I want the quality. I want the, you know, the good, tasty morsels to cross my palate and so forth. Of course, the upper class, it's all about presentation. Does it look fancy, you know? So it might take you a few bites. There was the President Trump had a hotel that he was running in D.C. while he was president. And so for my birthday, my wife and I said, I want to go to the Trump Hotel for supper. And I'm not a big steak person. I'm lazy. I don't have to chew my meat. So I saw caviar on the menu. I was like, I'm going to order caviar. Well, the caviar was a thimble. But it was the tastiest thimble I ever ate. It was very, very good caviar. But compared to, you know, steak and burgers, it wasn't much. But it looked great, and it was very tasty. So, you know, the wealthy, it's like about presentation, not about as much. I knew, you know, food for tomorrow. I wouldn't have to stuff myself that night, and I really didn't stuff myself. There was really hardly anything on that plate. But the upper income, it's like about presentation because they know it's coming. But we're also seeing an idea here is that if we look at poverty, it used to be poverty was if you were lacking food, you were just malnourished. There was lack of nutrition. What we're seeing today in the United States is there's an abundance of food, and now poverty is often associated with overeating. Still that desire for quantity and so forth. And so here's talking about adolescent overweight by family income. And so the overweightness goes down as family income goes up. So we're seeing in this country now that poverty is not always expressed as lacking food, but it's often about what's being eaten. It's not so much about quantity either. It's also about the processed foods and, you know, not having the right kind of calories and so forth. It's calories. But we're seeing that a flip here. And this can lead to all kinds of other issues with health. So there's health, there's wealth. All of this is often intertwined. We look at class. Could tie into past legacies of discrimination. Men and women not being treated equally in the workplace, or minorities being ejected from their jobs, or not being considered for the higher positions of management and so forth. There's a lot of injustice. I just chose Lynchburg since we're not too far from there. This is the mean household income by quintile in Lynchburg City. So quintiles, we have 20% levels and how much people are making here. And somebody that has better eyes here, what is the bottom quintile, the bottom 20% making average household income? I can see this about 12,000, okay? The upper income, upper 20% are making 77,000 on average, 73,000. The upper 5% then is the far side over here, almost double what the average of the top 20% is. And so there's a vast disparity, a vast gap here in income. Now, people's happiness can sometimes be tied to their class and income levels. And so for a household, let's say of four, once they reach $70,000, $75,000, their happiness kind of plateaus. So they will be happier going from 30, 40, 50, 60,000. Once you get to 70,000, 75,000, your happiness just kind of plateaus, it just kind of stabilizes. And so going up to 100, 200, $300,000, $400,000 a year won't add to your happiness. What comes back to Ecclesiastes about this? The rich have an abundance that's going to be to their hurt, and it could make them lose sleep because they're worried about their investments. And so there's a threshold here, and David even talks about this in the Bible. Lord, help me not to be so poor that I curse you, or so rich that I forget you. And so not that I'm trying to say we as believers should try to aim to be middle class, but knowing when enough is enough, and knowing not to waste our life and our careers and our goals on chasing a dream that may not. We can't guarantee tomorrow, let alone where we'll be in our 70s and 80s, if we'll be here. So put all this into perspective. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 50. Maybe you hear this kind of talk and you feel very concerned. This is injustice. What about the poor? They're being oppressed, and what should we do about this? Job is told, that maybe it's because you're wealthy that you have all this suffering. You get what you deserve. Well, the reality of the situation is there is inequality in the world. There is injustice. There are people who are exploiting, oppressing us, and trying to use people's labor for someone. That's the reality of the situation. Before I read from Isaiah, I want to go to my next slide here. This little cartoon says, on the left-hand quadrant says reality. This is equality, then equity, then reality is there's three guys here. They're trying to watch a baseball game. And I don't know how well you can see it from the back there, but the one guy, he is on like multiple boxes here, crates. He's standing up on the very top. He has no trouble seeing the baseball game. He has more need to see in his bleacher view here. The guy in the middle here, he is up just high enough. His neck's right at the top of the fence. He can watch the game, no trouble. There's another guy down here in the ditch. He's like almost below the fence. He can't see a thing. Some people can see, have more than they need to see. Others can't see at all, and others are kind of right there in between. So to get to equality, you might say, well, we'll give everybody the same amount. And so we'll give you all one box to stand on. Well, this doesn't really change anything for the guy in the middle. The guy in the top, he can still see as well as he did before. The other guy, though, he's out of the ditch, but he still can't see. Now we see something about his birth. He was just, his height matters. He's a little short. He still can't see through the fence. So we can try to make things equal. You all get the same, let's say you can all be born with the same parents, the same income. Well, some people still won't have the ability to see or get ahead. So to make it all not equal opportunity, but equal outcome, to get them all with the same level heads, we call that equity. Equity. Now, the shorter guy here, he has two boxes down. The guy in the middle still has one box, and they're all at the same level. It's equity. So we're hearing this a lot in our world today, the idea of equity being more important than equality. Equity being more important than equality, because you can give everybody, $1,000 when they're born, and what will they do? It's not going to, equality won't measure up. Some people will say, well, my parents got $1,000 and they drank it up last night. And others will say, my parents got $1,000 and they invested in my college fund. And others say, I got $1,000 and they gave it away. And so it's not all going to be the same. So equality, you all get the same start, doesn't necessarily help. Equity, though, how to make that more, well, that's where we get this diversity, equity, and inclusion idea, is trying to make everything equitable. Everybody has the same outcome, the same experience. And the fourth quadrant here says, well, we got to do something about this to make this happen. Forget the boxes. Take down the fence. Then we'll have justice. And so we got to, overthrow capitalist society and overthrow our oppressive patriarchies, and we'll solve the word about gender, race, or class. You guys tie this in here. Have justice. Create justice. Well, Isaiah 58, verse 4 says, behold, ye fast for strife and debate and to smite with a ye shall not fast as you do this day to make your voice to be heard on high. Some people are fasting, and there's a spiritual discipline that I'm not the most skilled at. Let's just put it nicely like that. It's not my skill to be a faster. But is our goal of fasting to be heard on high, to get our voices heard by the highest Or, he says, it's such a fast that I have chosen a day for man to afflict his soul as to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread a sackcloth. And call this a fast, an acceptable day of the Lord. So you're just going to starve yourself. Is that fasting? Is that what I'm calling for? Well, is not this the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? Thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house. When thou seest the naked, thou clothe him and cover him, that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. Then shall the light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go forth before thee. Be thy rearward, like a flag behind and in front of you. And so, is this calling for a revolution? To break down the bands of wickedness and oppression and break it all apart and take down the fence of inequities that we're called to do? I might take Isaiah 58 here out of text, context, and say, okay, time for a revolutionary Mennonite movement to get started. You know, the Young Mennonite Revolutionaries of America or whatever. That's army spelled backwards. So try to do something to, be violent and overthrow. How do we view wealth? We might have had some skewed versions of wealth, some skewed visions of how wealth is carried out. The Tennessean who does personal finance, I mentioned earlier, also has what he calls the... He shows if somebody from the age of zero... As a newborn, I saw a seven-week-old here this morning. That's exciting to see. If somebody would take that newborn and put 30 months invest for her in mutual funds every month until she's 65, $13 a month, she'd be a millionaire. Now, if you're 20, you have less time. It takes $95 to that level, but it's still going to be $95 a month invested every month. Until you're 65, you'd be a millionaire. Not that hard to be a millionaire in this country, in this context. So, is millionaire status out of reach? Choose how to invest. But I won't take the time to go there. I'm going to run out of time again. Job 20, one of Job's friends, critics, enemy, frenemies, whatever, comes along and says, you're vomiting up the wealth you accumulate. It's your fault that you have all this that Satan brought upon you. It's your fault. You brought in all this riches. You're going to just vomit up. So we might blame the rich, blame the wealthy, blame the one percenters, blame the, and we've seen movements like that. You know, it's time to 1%. Is that how to carry out Isaiah 58? Or let's look at Proverbs chapter 3. Verse 9, honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of all thine increase, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. Goes on in chapter 13, verse 22, a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. You know, we hear the meek shall inherit the earth. So maybe this wealth multiplier that people do invest, you can invest in charitable foundations. Expand your widow's mite to reach those who need it. And you can not cover yourself from the poor. So maybe those with wealth can give in abundance. I heard about a Mennonite Bible Institute that went to a very wealthy man's house. He owns a big smorgasbord in Pennsylvania, which I love to eat there. I like quantity. So anyways, it was also quiet. Never had a bad taste there. But they went to his house. They were to judge him. He's a wealthy man. He's obviously going hunting in Africa of animals around his den. And so they're ready to judge him. Then they realize that he has been sending shipments of food, entire containers on ships to needs around the world, including their Bible Institute at one time. And they realize we were judging him. He's been more than we ever could hope to give in our lifetime. So can we, if you get abundance, if you're born to abundance, if you choose to make good investments that someday lead to abundance. Well, you're keeping it for yourself, good of others. What are you going to do with these choices? You have the ability to save a dollar now. If you're 18, it can be $88 when you're 65. Or do you squander it now, waste on yourself now, or waste on yourself when you're 65? Not all retirees are making good choices with their money either. So there's a lot about choice here. I'm going to close with looking at James chapter 2. Because our ideal here this weekend is that we will be choosing to his family, his kingdom, his church, his nation, his royal priesthood. As royalty, we don't need to worry about tomorrow. Our Father owns the cattle on a thousand hills. Disclaimer, I will say that as we look at gender, race, and class, we as Christians, maybe to zero in further, maybe identify as Anabaptist or Mennonite, we have not done everything correctly. So I'm not saying that Mennonites are perfect on gender, class, or race. But I have an ideal that we can be. If we are following the word, we can make this a refuge from the inequities of the world. We can take care of the least of these, my brothers and sisters. We can take care of those around and not hide ourselves and shield ourselves off and wall ourselves off from the oppression around us. Ideal is what I'm looking at this week. How can we choose to have this ideal? James chapter 2, my brethren, have not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect of persons. For they come unto your assembly a man with a gold ring and goodly apparel, and there come in also a poor man in vile raiment that weareth the gay clothing, and say to him, sit thou here in a good place, and say to the poor, stand thou there, or sit there under my footstool. Are you not then partial yourselves, and ye are become judges of evil thoughts? Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the world rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he hath promised to them that love him? But ye have despised the poor. Good pastor read, I'd encourage you to go on there. But the idea is we can make a good, equitable, just place without revolution, without condemning the rich and judging them. But we can do things with what God has presented. We have the resources as a body of Christ to take care of the body of Christ. Suffering to come in, get away from their unjust world of discrimination and oppression and exploitation, and come into the church that I know we can be. May not have always been that way, but we can be a church, an ideal where everybody is able to. And you say, hey, you need this week, and instead of setting this up for my future generations or my retirement, I want to help you. I want to bless you. God bless.